Some of the best learning you'll get is like on those rides up and down the mountain. It's like a 2-hour drive. He'll tell you this really obscure story about his life when he was a kid and this really tiny tidbit of what he saw his mom do with weaving. You just open this door of, oh shit, I was looking the wrong direction the whole time. This is amazing.
You're listening to Seamside, where we explore the inner work of textiles. I'm your host, Zach Foster, and today we sit down with sixth-generation Dene weaver and sheepherder Tyrell Tapaha. Before we sit down with Tyrell, though, two quick pieces of business. Number one, your review. Check this out from Whisks and Words, who said, I feel simultaneously all chilled out and all psyched up. God, I love that. Whisk and Words said, I come to each new episode knowing for sure that I will, one, feel blissed out by the tempo and tenor and the whole vibe that Zach creates with his guests. Two, feel so very awake with inspiration and new ideas to think through. And three, feel so ready to get back to my own creative practice. A great listen for creative folks of all stripes. Whisk and Words, I love that so much. Knowing that these Seamside conversations are getting you all jazzed up to jump into your studio and make work brings me so much joy. Thank you for sharing that with us. If you know what Whisk and Words is talking about, you feel a similar kind of inspiration or appreciation for these conversations, I'd invite you to leave a review, a kind 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It really is a wonderful way for other folks to discover the magic that is Seamside. The other thing I wanted to share with you is that I've recently put together a short little ebook that you can download for yourself, 14 pages, called 10 Things I Wish I'd Known Before I Started Quilting. And it's a series of 10 reflections that would have been really helpful to the younger Zach 10 years ago that was starting quilting. Reflection number one, for example, is, there's no way to actually plan a quilt. Hot take, I know. But if I had realized that pattern quilts were only one kind of quilting back when I first started, it'd have been a whole new world. So to get your copy of this free ebook, 10 Things I Wish I'd Known When I Started Quilting, check out the link in the show notes below, and I'll zip it to your inbox immediately, and you'll be reading your copy of 10 Things in no time. Now, on with today's show. Tyrell Tapaha, a sixth-generation Dene weaver and sheepherder, will tell you there's nothing really special about his work that belongs specifically to them. And while it may be true that there's nothing new under the sun and that all artists draw from deep wells of collective creative experience, I can't help but think that there's something special about Tyrell's work. The use of text, the collage-like shift in weaving patterns, the subject matter, all sets his work apart. In this Seamside conversation, Tyrell and I discuss the intrinsic differences between sheep and goats, how his great-grandmother's loom fits oh so perfectly on top of his car, and how to balance preserving tradition and forging new pathways. I hope you enjoy How to Tend the Flock with my new friend, Tyrell Tapaha. Welcome to Seamside, Tyrell.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
So good to see you. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty damn good. It's a really comfortable, cozy morning so far. And there's no complaints on my end.
I'm glad to hear it. And we've both shown up wearing blue hats. I think that's the sign.
Yeah, I try and fight it, but I think blue's one of my favorite colors to wear. Also to work with. I can't escape it.
And so what do you think it is about blue, and why do you fight it?
I don't know. I think it just hits the room differently. Also, at least just in working with it, I really love what you can get with in mashing with other colors. Good contrast.
So if blue isn't your favorite color, then what is?
I love me a green.
Oh, so not that far off.
Yeah, not that far off on Reggie Biv, but yeah. We also, as humans, see the most shades of green.
Right. Because we need that vegetation for life.
It's true. Our eyes are good at doing things.
And apparently I've heard too, like the reason that our eyes are drawn to like sparkly objects is because evolution trained us for water detection. Oh, there's water in the distance. Let me go there and survive.
Sparkle, sparkle.
Sparkle, sparkle. Yeah. Okay. So between you and me, Tyrell, I've always said that my least favorite color was orange, but just this week, I had to add a whole new crate to my fabric stash. And so for those of you who don't know what my fabric stash system is, I have a crate for every color. But for the longest time, orange and yellow shared a crate. And I'm like, orange. But over the last year or so, I guess I've been like, my relationship with orange has been evolving. And I've been coming across more and more orange out in the world that I like, and I bring it home. And so now I had enough orange that merited its own crate, which I think now officially means I can no longer say that I don't care for orange. In fact, orange, I love you.
Yeah, proof's in the pudding. Whole crate and everything.
Exactly, exactly. It's having a good moment, orange. So Tyrell, tell us where you are right now.
I am currently at my childhood home in Kirtland, New Mexico, generalized Four Corners area of the States, and it is a really nice, clear, sunny day, and I am currently just plopped down at the kitchen table. I was doing some weaving before this, and yeah, pretty slow and humble start to the day.
Those are often my favorite ways to start a day.
I think it's my most preferred. I unfortunately am a night owl as of late, so that's less than ideal. But this time of day is probably my favorite time of day. Mm-hmm. I feel a little more human than normal.
Well, good. I'm glad we're catching you at your most human. This is the time. Now, do you weave at home? Do you work at home?
Well, since Navajo weaving, the loom structure is pretty much just like sticks and string. I'm somewhat of a nomad in my busier time of the year. I definitely can weave anywhere I go. I have a little small loom that I lug around with me. So for at least like travel purposes, I always have that. And then I've cached like a couple of my larger looms in different places. So I can take down like the actual project and just set it up in different areas. But outside of weaving, like I am just a chronic fidgeter. So if I'm not weaving, I'm usually like knitting, or I've just been doing a lot of patchwork as of late. So that's also been killing time.
Tyrell, I got to see some of this patchwork.
I know.
Quilter to quilter.
I don't know about quilter, but I have been known to sew things.
Okay. Well, after this conversation, maybe you can give me a sneak peek. How about that?
Perfect. Okay. I think that sounds fair.
Now, when I think of a loom, and I have very little weaving experience, I'll say that up front. When I think of a loom, I think of what I saw in my friend Jenny's one-bedroom Brooklyn apartment, which was a massive floor loom, I think is what they're called. Hundreds of year old, like this big structure. Like
big old box.
The big old box. And some people have couches in their living room. There was no room for that, right? Like it was just straight up loom. But that's not what you're weaving on.
Yeah. A Navajo loom is pretty much just, in essence, as I've touched on, like just sticks and string, but pretty much is supported just by any upright framing. In the past, it's been tree limbs and the tension created between like either fastening the bottom bar of the loom to like rocks or caching like certain logs to the ground and then creating that tension with a cord on that tree branch. Or nowadays, people have huge metal. I have probably four larger size loom, the largest being like an 8 foot long by like 7 foot tall wooden loom. And then my favorite one that I end up using is a welded metal loom that I was definitely like maybe 3 times my age. So yeah, I definitely bounce around a lot. And of course, like I said, I have a little small wooden one that I lug around with me pretty consistently.
And what is it about that one welded loom that makes it your preferred loom?
As much as I like wooden looms, especially on a larger scale, because of the ones that I've inherited, they're pretty damn old and getting pretty rickety that their joinery isn't really all that well solid. So like a welded loom, that sucker's not going anywhere. It's also just small enough to fit on top of my vehicle. So when I go places for extended amounts of time, or like if I just want to bring my loom with me, I can actually like fasten it onto the top of my ride. So I like that. It's been pretty helpful. But yeah, it's also just like the perfect, like when I warp or set up a new warp, that's just like the perfect dimension. I feel like I just have it dialed down and I've made a relationship with that loom and those specific materials that I'm just like, okay, this is the default.
Yeah, I have a default size for quilting, which is about 5 feet by 5 feet. Like, there's just something that feels good about the relationship to my body, to the object, that just feels like, oh, this is just natural. So I don't even think about it much anymore.
Exactly. Like, I probably look really silly carrying that loom to and fro, but at least even just where to grab it on the loom to carry it around, I feel like I just have those proportions pretty well checked in my brain.
And so if this loom is 3 times as old as you are, do you know anything about its life before it came to live with you?
Yeah. So for those who don't know, I'm 6th generation weaver. I don't know who comes up or starts counting those like arbitrary generational titles, but at least weaving has been pre-existing prior to that counting. But I'm sure they're alluding to more so like the sheep and weaving aspect of the lineage. So this loom, or my larger loom that I was referring to, the wooden one, that one I inherited from my great-grandmother. And so she passed. I never really got to see her in her weaving prime, but I had a relationship with her. And she kind of fits like the classic trope of a classically trained Navajo weaver. Of this is all she did. She was a single mom for a good chunk of her parenting. All she did was ranching, either it was cattle, sheep. Really well established and prominent quilter in the community. But that loom was pretty much her bread and butter for as long as I could understand. And she usually did a lot of large scale work. She came from that generation where that was like the default and kind of the norm. And when she passed in 2018, she already had been stopped weaving for maybe about a decade at that point. And when she passed, my grandmom, her daughter, had been using it as a clothes rack, outdoor clothes rack. And just so happened, I really had established my practice at that point. So I approached and was like, hey, there's a big loom here. I want to do larger scale things. What's the math look like for me getting this? And I think it was a fresh wound. So they were like, I don't know. I'll think about it. And then maybe like a month later or so, it just ended up in my front yard. And I've had that sucker ever since.
You have your great-grandmother's loom. Do you have anything that she wove?
Not that specific great-grandmother. That is my mom's dad's mom. My mom's mom, my grandma's mom, we're matrilineal society Navajos. So I definitely have just like a stronger affinity for my relationship to my mother's side of the family. But that specific great-grandmother, yes, I have one of her works. I have a bunch of different types of ephemera from her. Like the batten that I use and some of my tools, like she made. A lot of my finishing combs that I use, she's the one who made them. I have one of her saddle blankets that she wove. I sit on that pretty consistently, slash is like my lumbar support when I go on long drives. And I think my favorite thing, which kind of also goes into the medium that I do, is they came from an entirely different generation who experienced such a very different world from what I can even wrap my head around. And so a lot of their ingenuity really like seeps into a lot of different pockets of my life in a lot of different regards. One of my favorite ones is, so she didn't really speak a lick of English. She could say her name and she could write her name for like signature purposes. But because she didn't write anything down, for a lot of her tool counts or a lot of her specific familial designs that she picked up, she made these tiny little sample looms and she would weave them like halfway. And they're maybe about 6 inches tall by 4 inches wide, just really tiny pieces. And she used those to keep her counts, which I think is just ingenious, because I'm just like, whoa, that's the best way to do things. But I have maybe four or five of her little samplers that she wove. And so that kind of comes up into my work pretty consistently. So
what is it like when you're weaving on a piece and you're using some of these ephemera, as you call them, from your great-grandmother? What enters into that experience, that moment, your mind?
I think there's a lot of different things that cycle through. One of them being some level of pride, preservation, not only like on a familial front, but also within like my relationship with myself. Something that I circle back to pretty consistently is the idea of like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So it's like really piecing together a puzzle with no picture on it. So it's really fun. Yeah, it's pretty much like, yeah, doing a puzzle upside down. Like, you don't really know what the image is on the other side. You know that the pieces fit, but like, when you get a chance to look at every one of those individual pieces and find its place, you're like, no shit. This is the best way to do things. And this is something that has already been well established. And it's been a really interesting kind of perspective, given that I don't really consider myself a classically trained weaver. A lot of the weavers in my family are pretty much self-taught. Like, we've bare minimum had someone to reference and to look at and to maybe ask questions to about the logistics and mechanics of the work. But when it actually gets down to the nitty gritty and learning the medium and that familiarity, it's pretty much you're just thrown into the deep end. And so piecing together a lot of these little tips and tricks has been really interesting, not only for like my ego, because I'm just like, oh, well, I figured something out, but also to know that it's a pre-existing relationship that I get to be a part of and to contribute my own voice and to also like tend my vine in relationship with people in my family who aren't here anymore. I wouldn't be where I am if they didn't do the groundwork for me to be here. It's this weird clusterfuck of like familial ties and I don't know. Good.
It can be complex and complicated. I mean, life often is, almost always.
Yeah, and I think it would just be one thing if I focused on one aspect of the work or the practice where it's just weaving, but I really went headfirst and jumped into this whole sheep to loom aspect. That was really what kind of got me into a lot of the practice, was the sheep is what brought me back. One, my fascination with just the stewardship and as well as the ecology, but also again, like the family aspect, the practice of it all. That's just like really what captivated me.
And I want to hear more about your sheep. But before we get on to that, I want to pick up with a thread that you mentioned a few minutes ago. And you said that your great-grandma's samplers, like, find their way back into your work. And I would love to hear more about how you see that happening.
I see it happening in that, not only in, I guess I enjoy incorporating techniques, not only from a learning perspective and historical perspective, but also preserving them and being able to document them. I really look at weaving as inherently, like, documentary. I see that on a lot of different fronts of looking at a lot of historical works. They really captured weavers' lives pretty well. And even down into like touching the works themselves, you can like, even with these like perfectly symmetrical designs, you can feel the piece and find out which side they started on. A lot of the, you can like piece it apart and put together a lot of their thought processes. You can see like a lot of different tension struggles with the work. And you're like, oh man, they must have had a shitty day or whatever it may be. They may have adjusted their loom a little differently than what they were used to. And so just piecing together a lot of these aspects, it's hard to not want to have my own rendition and take on that relationship. So by incorporating a lot of these techniques and familial related designs, specifically within Navajo weaving, and then even just in the general pop cultural eye, there's been some type of like resurgence for traditions and maintaining a lot of those ties. There's no shortage of weavers, but there is a shortage of everyone doing everything sheep to loom. So in maintaining a lot of these familial ideas, I feel like that's the aspect that really separates my work from a lot of other people.
And so what inspired you to want to stretch the process, stretch yourself beyond just the weaving and go to from sheep to loom, as you're saying?
One, the pandemic hit. So it gave me time to focus on a bigger scope of the process. No, in that when I look at my relationship with weaving, all of these factors that I'm alluding to, that's the whole picture that I saw. I understood weaving from a mechanical perspective at a pretty young age. So like in terms of piecing that together, that never really was like much of a struggle for me. And even when I was younger, like most of the help that I would do would be like in wool processing or like herding the sheep, give our sheep herder a break and go out with my grandma for like a few hours. I started to, in my undergrad, I was weaving for petty cash. I was working three jobs. I was full-time in my program. And then, as I mentioned, I would just weave on the side. And when the pandemic hit and wrapped up school, it ended up being this conversation of, I'm enjoying this relationship. I enjoy learning and piecing together a lot of this, but what part am I missing? And so I have a background in ecology, and just coming back from like a land use perspective, Navajos, we're very ranching and farming oriented. Agriculture and land usage and land relationship to land is inherently part of the culture. So that just seemed like a really obvious landing point and next step within that kind of thought process. But like I said, I started touching base. I had reached out to my granduncle, who is pretty much the mainstay and last generation to carry on the sheep herding like lifestyle and lifeway. And I just think it's funny because he's this classic old school queen. And given that he's pretty much the only artist in our family, it was just funny growing up and seeing him like tucked in the corner making like innuendos during like family functions. And I'm like, oh, cool. That's like my gay granduncle. But then when I started reaching out about the sheep herding and approached him about maybe apprenticing under him, because he had already started some level of programming like that, I was like, oh shit, this old queen really knows what he's talking about. And at that point, it was pretty much like a can of worms of alluding back to being thrown into the deep end of self-learning. It really just opened this next chapter of, I've been looking in the wrong direction this whole time. I've been looking at such a tiny little peephole from this huge picture that encompasses so much of not only my family livelihood on multiple fronts, but also it gave me like a checklist of things that I'm fascinated and wanted to learn more about.
What does your great uncle think about your work?
Oh, it's a great question. I wish you would tell me. I think going back into, again, that coming from a fairly conservative part of the world, and specifically within like older generation Navajo demeanors, like emotional expression isn't just like table talk. It's always fairly dismissive and or like very low key. And I feel that on a lot of different fronts with my family. But specifically with him, I think it goes into like humbling me, but he won't ever like compliment me to my face or like directly. He'll talk to other people, and a lot of the gigs that I started picking up, whether they're like teaching related or even down into like the curative things that I've dabbled into, a lot of those ties and networking had been established by him. When I end up in those conversations, they're like, man, your granduncle's so proud of you. He's so amazed at everything that you've been doing. And I was like, shoot, I never heard this before, so that's good.
I'm glad he's telling somebody.
Yeah, I was like, shoot. But again, and like even just into my relationship with him, it's very like, as I mentioned, like old school queen, a lot of jabs, a lot of grilling. It's hard to get lost in that. But overall, I would say like he's fairly proud. Like a lot of my apprenticeship too, like I use apprenticeship, but again, it's like very casual learning. We live at the base of a mountain. During the winter, we do a lot of our herding and all of our operations down below at the house. And then summertime, we take him up to the top of the mountain. I'm just in like, my studio ends up being like this 12 by 14 foot old cabin built in like the 60s. And so like some of the best learning you'll get is like on those rides up and down the mountain. It's like a 2 hour drive. So he'll just like tell you this really obscure story about his life when he was a kid and this really tiny tidbit of what he saw his mom do with weaving. You just open this door of, oh shit, I was looking the wrong direction the whole time. This is amazing. And so in terms of like where he shows his pride and where he shows like his respect for my work, it's usually in those spaces and those types of settings. We are peers. I see you see me, and I'm going to share this with you because I know it's going to help you and further your work.
It sounds like a fleeting moment, but very special.
I feel insanely grateful that I have what I have and to have it as accessible as I have it. There's not a lot of people who have a chance to experience those, let alone like get to intimately and interactively work with those.
And what about the sheep? What is your relationship to your sheep?
Pretty damn intimate. I describe sheep herding as nonverbal camp counseling. Because I'm not working on a commercial scale, and we're working with a heritage breed like Navajo Churro. Navajo Churro and Navajo Angora are pretty much the predominant sheep and goat breed that we work with. And we've had them ever since contact, the first domesticated sheep breed brought to the Americas. So we've had them since the Spanish were here. And we have a huge historical and cultural relationship with the sheep. And so having reverence in that regard has always been pretty well established in my mind, like even seeing like the way that my grandparents and my great grandparents took care of their livestock and even talked to them and communicated. We have prayers and like ceremonies that we do for them seasonally. So like seeing that growing up and working with that now, like that's one aspect of the relationship. They're like a divine entity that hats off to. But also, like I said, on the more personal level, it's really interesting getting to know every one of these people. I describe them as people. They're really good teachers and educators, not only from like a personality perspective, because I get to spend so much time with them, but also getting to see what they eat, what every individual character, you know, what their favorite food and snack is, the places that they like to go, the types of water that they'll drink, which ones are curious, which ones really don't care about me, and getting to see their lineages. Like, I know who your grandma was. I was a kid when I saw your great-grandmother. I remember the ram that fathered your mom's mom, or whatever it may be. All of these behind-the-scenes details about what makes the flock, I think that's probably one of my most favorite parts about the work. Another fun aspect is we're like in some pretty prime country. So being able just to be outside every day with them, working with them, and knowing, again, that you're tending this pre-existing lineage, it's just like one of the most fascinating parts about the sheep. One of my favorite things to do, and honestly, like when I think about like my personality in its most true essence, is just usually sitting and watching the sunset with the sheep in the evenings. The smells, the sounds, the views, like I feel like I'm my best self in those moments. And I'm really glad that it's in the company of people and creatures like them. I really am just ever fascinated at what they can teach me. I'm probably one of the most impatient people I know, but usually those suckers teach me to like pump the brakes pretty heavy.
Leading up to the pandemic, I would go for a couple of weeks every year during my February break here in New York. I would go see a friend who raises sheep and goats upstate. So I would see them just passing glances, relatively speaking. But it did teach me real fast that, like, as a human, I have very little control over other creatures. Very little. I like to see myself as one who is in charge and organizing things, but sheep and goats have very different ideas.
Agreed. Even now, specifically goats. Goats are...
Specifically goats.
They are those guys are way too smart for their own good, but they're probably my favorite and honestly have been my greatest teachers in life. From like a cultural perspective, we have our clan system in place, which is pretty much just like our little ID card of who you are, where you come from, and like who your family is. But the clan that I come from / is my mom's side of the like family is Kozofanem, which is like the many goats clan. I think it even ties into the greater interest that I have of weaving, but more so like, again, going into relationship with the goats. As much as those guys make me pull my hair, like, they're probably like my favorite in the flock. They're usually the leaders in the flock too. So also, yeah, look, I got a little goat tattoo.
Is that a specific goat?
Yeah, it's one of my, oh, I have another goat tattoo, but this is my favorite goat. If anyone ever has a chance to look at some of my work, all of the mohair that is featured in my work comes from that specific goat.
And which goat is that?
She doesn't really have a name, but like, it's called her stripe face. She was the leader of the flock for a really long time, and more specifically, like when I started coming back and herding full time. But my grandpa put her in some Thanksgiving stew 2 years ago. Classic lesson of don't get attached. Love them, respect them, but also...
It's all part of the cycle.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was really sad. But I still have her fleece, I have her hide that I tan. So I'll use her locks pretty consistently in my work.
Tyrell, why don't we take a look at some of your work now as a way of getting to know you and your sheep and your goats and your place in this world even better. Thank you for that foundation. When we were thinking about this conversation, you said a really good starting point would be think for yourself. You said that was a turning point for you in 2022. Can you tell us why that piece stands out to you among all your pieces?
Yeah, it just felt like such an interesting time in my life, not only being like a young 20 something, but like also really establishing the work ethic and made me choose a path and a direction that I felt that weaving could take me to, could teach me about where I came from, where I am, and where I'm going. And I mean, I feel like every work that I put out brings that conversation to the table, but more specifically with this one, it was the first large-scale piece that I did by myself. Kind of like the beginning-ish middle part of my apprenticeship that I keep alluding to. As well as like really showcased like what I'm capable of. Up until this point, I was doing pretty like small to like medium-scale pieces. And then again, I was helping like my grandfather, granduncle with his larger-scale works. And so this piece really talked about like this overstimulation I was experiencing too in life. I had just recently moved to central Utah. I worked as a caretaker for the place that I worked at during the summers. And so I was pretty much just locked in this little cabin and snowed in pretty consistently in the winter. Seasonal depression usually hits me like a truck. So I was definitely like lost in the sauce. And it just seemed like it was like my first time being vulnerable with the work at that capacity, that scale, and for that long of a time frame. This honestly too started like the seasonal shift that I tend to work in, which is like I'll do most of my large scale works during the winter. And so like even down into the design layout and the thought process, like I always look at my work as some level of like tangible memories, because there is an obvious beginning and there is an end. There is a start date and an end date. I'm not the same person when I am starting the work, whether it be warping or even weaving the first few lines, or even down into like the spinning, the dyeing, and all of the work that actually has to come before me sitting down at the loom, which is the majority of the practice. It really opened this conversation of time isn't linear. As part of that, I am not the same person from the starting point to the end point. And I, for the sake of like time scales, it's one of the biggest learning curves that I've had in my life, and more specifically my practice, that I hadn't really ever been exposed to prior to this relationship. And so like the bottom portion of this piece really is just very chaotic. So there was a lot of different techniques I was studying at the time, a lot of different things that I wanted this piece to be. I wanted it to be like 10 different things. And but every time I would move like another couple inches, I'm like, okay, cool, it's going to be something else. Okay, it's going to be something else after this next part. And then by the time I finished the lower third of the work, I was like, this is not at all what I wanted it to be. It's not at all who I thought I was. It's not at all who I really saw in myself as well. So it created this really interesting mirror that I really wasn't anticipating to see this early on quotations in my practice. And then the halfway point, you really see this sudden change and shift in design layout. It feels like you can like visually see me focusing and putting attention on a specific idea at that point. And so this is also the first large scale incorporation of one of the more prominent techniques that I picked up in my family so far. And it has a colloquial name of siripadot, which means like the bird's bill. So it's also dolvasa yezhe, which is like fem lightning. From a historical context, that's a pretty much a design that's been endemic to my neck of the woods and area of the Navajo Nation, but also specifically with the bird's bill outline. That is a technique that only my granduncle and I know now within our whole community. And so really seemed like a like stark shift in the direction of my work from that point on. And then I opened up this can of worms of where did I come from? So I wove both of my great grandmothers, Mary Katie Claw on the left side of the work in purple. She is the matriarch of the weaving lineage that I talk about. And then on the right side is Fanny Yazzie, who is the grandmother who I set up this work on. Like the loom that I talked about, that large scale loom, this is her loom that I set this work up on. It all kind of started falling into place. I started really analyzing like where I wanted my work to go. And at that point I started picking up steam. As I was wrapping up the work, I felt like I wanted to balance it out to some degree. And I decided to put this Diné philosophy that comes up in one of our ceremonies of Atah Ntijikes, which is a statement that is directed towards the viewer and listener of think for yourself, going into this idea of being at a time where we actually have creative agency for the type of work that we produce, being able to have an entirely different market to sustain and take care of ourselves in a different way that we've been exposed to. It felt like a very honest conversation to have with myself for the first time.
I love your telling of this piece, Tyrell, because I think you approach it as a way a weaver would, I believe, and not like a quilter, go figure. Because I'm so fascinated that you start at the bottom and you talked us through from the bottom up, which is, I'm assuming, how you would weave the piece, right?
Yeah, sequentially, yeah.
it makes perfect sense. But I'm like, I would never start at the bottom of a quilt and begin describing it to somebody. But it makes sense. I think this is this collage aspect in your weaving that made me really want to talk to you and to get to know you and your work better, because there's so much happening here. And from your use of the figurative and from your use of text, you know, I love text, and the combination of patterns, all of it, there's just so much. And so we'll get images of this on the episode webpage for people to see for themselves. But thank you for painting a verbal picture of this weaving for us. It's really lovely. Another piece I'd really love to hear you share with us about is Dine Rhapsody. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a really funky piece that, from a technical perspective, was a really large study and application of a lot of the historical and familial techniques that I've been alluding to. But also in terms of content and inspiration, it also comes from a pretty corny place of, this was like my honeymoon piece with a specific relationship that I was working with at the time. And I feel like everyone has to have like their corny little love piece. And so this is a piece that I wove a landscape. The landscape is the perspective of the mountain. I live by Carrizo Mountain from my great-grandmother's house. It's also like, when I think of home, that's the image that comes to mind. There's the road to her house goes up a hill in the foothills of the mountain, and it just heads directly for it. And so it feels like the world just opens up in front of you. And it's just like a classic image that I see in my head. And it felt like a study of different types of techniques. I had been incorporating a lot of European tapestry techniques. So like blending hachure and sumac, which is like an outlining and texture effect. That kind of, we see a lot in French techniques, as well as incorporating different types of ephemera, like the mohair at the bottom of the piece, and even like the text message, which is kind of the centerpiece of the work itself. And admittedly, I just wanted to do something more of a landscape piece, a little larger size of a work, as well as I set it up when I was pretty much like playing house with this person. And they're based in Brooklyn, and I was there pretty consistently for work. So like, spent like a few weeks at a time with them. And at this time, like, I set up this work pretty much to be a showboat and be like, hey, here's my big room in my room. The scale definitely was like premeditated in being a showboat in that regard. But it was a really interesting time because I had been bouncing back and forth. It felt like it was a pivotal time in my career, and like I had been getting more collectors, bigger name collectors. Institutions had started purchasing my work, and so this kind of became the default norm. I'd also been doing a lot of curation within these spaces, and so my professional life had been really taking off at this point. And so I really wanted to dive into having a work that spoke on kind of more my personal life. And so as part of that is the incorporation of the male and female lightning designs that I had been talking about. This is the first piece that has incorporated those two together since my great-grandmother. She had been doing work like that maybe in the late 80s at the very latest. But I even think that may have gone further back. Currently, there's no documentation of both of those designs being put together. Probably somewhere tucked away in some private collection or someone's closet somewhere, maybe. But this had been a study and a chapter that my granduncle had offered up to me. He's like, hey, you should, like, next thing you should do, like, you should put those two designs together. Because I had really taken to them. I kind of had cracked the code of getting the count right for the smaller lightning design. And so it was just this really weird thing. I'm like in the heart of Brooklyn pretty consistently, and I'm commuting it almost every day to West 86th. For work, and kind of living the classic Brooklyn, New York artist trope, but also I'm still going back to go be a sheep herder in this very remote part of the reservation. And I wanted a piece like this to capture that, as well as, again, like I said, the splash of the love life, which is where the text message came from. When I moved back after this time in the city, and I only have like good-ish cell service in our cabin. So at the end of the day or during my lunch breaks, I would send all my texts to the said lover and or like whatever it may be, scroll the gram or social media. But this is one of the more pivotal text messages that I got. And as I was piecing together like my winter project, this is one of the ideas that kept cycling back. Like he had said, where you are is so freaking amazing, as are you. And almost consistently, I had been sending him just pictures of like my life and sharing like intimate parts of who I see myself as and where I see myself while in that thought process. And I'm like inherently a lover, but opening my life and exposing myself at that capacity is fairly like uncommon for me. And so in terms of digesting that relationship, this piece really captured a lot of that. And then the top portion of the work, especially like the where the stars come out and like the ending of the piece, you can't really see it on the picture itself because it just lies flat. But like in person, the piece has a lot of tension. The edges start to come in a lot. And the black and white zigzag is a wedge weaving, which is a technique founded by Navajo weavers. So I wanted to riff off of that. But more specifically, the top left bigger white stripe was kind of like the formal ending of that relationship. And I remember that they knew that I was weaving this piece about them. It was like a pretty conceptual conversation in that regard. And then having that moment be like, okay, cool. This thing that I've been obsessed with for the past few months, if not a year, has just been swept out right under me. And I feel very awful. And this is really bad. And this is really not great. So the rest of this piece has the finishing parts of this piece have so much tension. You can just like visually see a lot of my discomfort from the work. It's a large scale piece. So like the downside of Navajo weaving is that it's a forced selvage weaving. So we don't cut anything to finish. And you have to like weave with a needle at the end and pretty much sew the weaving to finish it off. So not only was it grueling to have to go through the thick of the heartbreak and like the very initial wave of all of that, but also sit there and think about like, damn, I really did just spend my whole winter weaving a piece about a person who I was obsessed with just to finish it out and sit and sulk. But it also spoke to the overall design layout. The whirling logs and the hummingbird kind of really speak to that. You know, like you think you're one image of yourself at one moment going one direction just for you to be flipped 180 and go to another and for you to be reborn as this new person who you may not have ever anticipated or like even have had the most minuscule thought of seeing yourself as. In terms of this piece being a learning piece, it definitely threw me in the ringer and spit me out. But it's also one of my favorite for that reason. It just hits in a very different way, not only from like a visual perspective, but also like when I get a chance to see this, it lives over on Fifth Ave. When I go and visit, I'm just like, oh my God, I cringe that I love you in such like a such like an emotional time in my life. But also I'm like, wow, you exist. Like that time in my life existed, it happened, and I have physical evidence to talk about it. That's insane.
And they're woven into it are the rapturous. Woven into it is the rhapsody and then also everything that came afterwards, right?
It's all there. It's pretty silly.
No, but it's the stuff of life.
Yeah, if there's anything that I fight, it's just my humanity and that I have feelings. If there's anything my weaving can hold me accountable for, it's my humanity.
Amen, textiles. One last piece that I would really love to hear from you on is Chaos at Four Corners, one of your more recent pieces, right?
Yeah, that is a really funky piece. It also had become an entirely different shift in what I had been gearing my work towards. I set up my larger works or studies during the winter. And so this is just my most recent piece that I had finished maybe in January. I set it up at the beginning of November. And around this time, I had been talking about the specific like relationship and tie to my family on my mother's side. But going back into like the Fanny Yazzie, my mom's dad's mom, I had been spending a lot of time with their ranching operation, and they're like more cattle oriented, but they also have similar ties. Like they're pretty much on the opposite side of the mountain that I keep alluding to, Carrizo Mountain. And just seeing their perspective on life, how they got to where they are, and I had been spending a lot of time there as like pretty much like a ranch hand, it opened up this new conversation of like where I saw myself, where I saw my work, and how I see that in the community. And so also I'm just a better weaver nowadays, so I got to work on new different types of techniques that I had been thinking of. And so I set this piece up while there, and where I set it up, the materials that I use for my work is just as important as the actual context. So it felt really important to relight that torch with that part of my family and having that weaving existing there, having it being done there, and having it be part of the land and like that tending that line. And And so by having that conversation with that part of my family, you also end up having to assess why things are the way that they are in my part of the world. And so I wanted the focal point to be resource extraction, because this economy historically had been agricultural based, because we live right by the San Juan River. But also nowadays, the economy has been centered on, for the past few generations, around the extraction of resources. My great-great-grandparents worked in uranium. My great-grandparents worked in uranium. My grandparents worked in coal. My dad works in natural gas. And it's just been taking, taking, taking. And we're at this time in my people's history where a lot of these historical and familial practices and trades are dying out, because there's not enough people who are maintaining the land, have a relationship with the land, or have a relationship with the livestock and a lot of these things that have given us the identities that we claim and hold to within our families. When I think about the imaging of my life, I think about all of these factors of the extraction. And in all honesty, too, it has done nothing for the people. We still have one of the highest rates of substance abuse in the country, a lot of lack of sex education, just like on a lot of different fronts. We're in a really impoverished part of the country and within the states. And a plethora of statistics come into my mind of 60% of the Navajo Nation doesn't have running water. All of the water we have is contaminated from the decades of uranium extraction. All of the water is hot and contaminated and still leaching into the community and the water table. Even down into the house that I set up this loom or this piece in was a federally funded house that was given to my great-grandmother, because her original house, which is 6 feet away from this new house, had been condemned because of uranium contamination in this foundation. And even down into 200 yards away from the house, there was a fairly recently capped uranium mine. It just seemed like a really obvious part of the history of where I come from that we all see and have ties to, but we don't talk about. And so I'm kind of in this phase right now of Navajo weaving being inherently documentary, of wanting to give my community and myself more specifically a good mirror to look at and to assess where we are. When I think about that, I think about pipeline breaks, oil contamination, water table contamination, how that affects our livelihood as sheep herders, as cattle owners, as farmers, and even down into what it's given our community. You know, a lot of the miners during the uranium days, a huge chunk of the workers died from lung cancer, from the radon gas exposure. And that wasn't exclusive to the miners. The water contamination at the heyday of the uranium mining had given a lot of family members, and more specifically women, pancreatic and stomach cancer from drinking that contaminated water. And even down into I think it was 85 is when NASA had formally discovered the hole in the ozone layer. And one of those analyses had shown that the power plants and the air contamination was in the Four Corners, because we have two of the largest power plants in the Southwest, 8 miles away from each other, had created this a massive hole in the ozone right above Four Corners. When I think about all of these, I'm just how are we not talking about this on a community front, on a family front? It was just always talking about the money that the company was making, the livelihood that it paid the people. And even now, when people talk about having a good job, or people who live in comfort in this part of the world, they usually have jobs related to the mine or to the power plants. And even outside of all of that and what it provides for the economy, it goes even into our relationship within the federal government. Of the only reason the Navajo Nation has an autonomous governing body is because resources were found on the reservation, and the United States didn't communicate with tribal bodies without a formal government head. And so a lot of the decisions are made void of the community, totally based off of corporate greed and totally based off of outside funding that doesn't come from the nation, it's Navajo Nation itself. And so as part of those agreements and contracts that had been made as of recently, one of the more prominent ones is the relationship with the Raytheon Missile Company. There is a production plant maybe about 10 miles away from me that creates parts and raw goods for artillery uses. And so pretty much we have a missile plant that's 10 miles away from this whole weird extracting front that we all fund. And that's another job too, that like when you hear that someone works at Raytheon, you're like, oh wow, they are really well off and that is good for them, is like a good like common response. And I'm like, at what cost is all of this? We have a culture that's still really strong and lively and has so many ties that we can tend and so many things that we can learn from, but we're willfully and knowingly disregarding all of that for the sake of greed, for the sake of money. And I wanted to weave a piece that reflects that. This is one of the works that I had shown my grandparents that they didn't really need an explanation to see. Normally, given this collage aesthetic, I incorporate a lot of different funky design layouts that normally my grandparents need like an explanation of like, why did you weave it this way? Or why is this the way that it looks? Why are you working in this like way? And this is the first piece that I had shown them where they were like, oh, I totally get it. That makes sense. And then it opened this can of worm of why I wanted to weave this work, of opening and expanding this conversation. From when I first showed them that this work, I've heard stories I've never heard about before, specifically from those my grandparents. Right, one of my favorite ones that stuck out was my grandpa, who when he was in Boy Scouts in middle school and high school, like they would camp in these uncapped mines just because that was just the thing that they did. They didn't think anything of it. And to think about the exposure, my grandmother hauling water with an uncapped mine, maybe about like 200 feet away from the spring source. All of these crazy things that I'm just like, how are we not talking about this?
And at the top of this piece, Tyrell, I see what I assume is another night sky.
Yeah, I guess like pretty consistent design layout ties into our cosmology with our work. I think working with traditional mediums, you inherently pick up a lot of the cultural views of the practice, its functionality. And specifically with Navajo weaving, it's inherently tied to the reciprocity between Mother Earth and Father Sky. And just like the plants and all things that live on Earth, you know, they're fed from that reciprocity between those two entities. And more so, like, when I talk about the work, you know, there's a bottom to top kind of sequential process behind that. But just like everything within that cycle, we all grow from the Earth and we all go towards the sky. So usually when I get bored, or given that I weave a lot of landscapes, I like to weave the earth in the bottom and I like to put the sky on the top. And I don't know, I also just like weaving stars. I remember when I was wrapping up this piece, I have been dragging pretty hard. I honestly didn't think I was going to finish it at the time that I did, but I had gotten to the point just after the bombs that I wove of, I was like, should I just do plain colors at this point? It would just really save me some time and I can get it done. And I was like, I know I'm going to be really mad if I do that. That top border design came from a study that I was doing with my granduncle maybe about 2 years ago that I was wrapping up around the same time that I finished this piece. So I was like, yeah, we should do that again. And so it became the sky portion of the work.
It's gorgeous. And it's a beautiful documentation, like you say, of the world that as it currently is. For a lot of folks, let me ask you a dreamy question, if I may. And that is,
go for it.
Like, picture yourself at age 100, Tyrell, and you're still weaving, right? You still got the fingers, are still working. What kind of weavings do you hope to be doing at that point in your life? What kind of stories do you hope that you'll be able to portray on the loom?
Shoot, the hell if I know. I just know that I'll be weaving as long as I physically can. And just as I had prefaced with every individual piece, I'm a different person from the beginning to the end. I think that when I'm an old fart, I'll probably have nothing but time and sheep on my hand. So I would hope that it's something along those lines. But yeah, going back into beats me, I don't know. I don't even know what I'm going to weave next month. So,
right. And I guess my question is less of a crystal ball. You're painting the world as it is now, right? For us to be able to see and to recognize and to interpret the world in 2024. So if we zoom forward to the year 2100, what do you hope that you're seeing for yourself, for the Navajo Nation, for the Dena? What stories can you imagine weaving into one of these large-scale pieces?
I think it would probably be something on still talking about what I see every day, but also we're at a really interesting time in general period, but also, again, from where I come from and the community that I come from, there are a lot of different factors in play at the moment that make me really questionable of the livelihood that we were brought up in. A lot of the life ways, practices, ceremonies, our relationship to language. And I would hope that from now until I'm that decrepit old man, that I can capture a lot of what we have still and a lot of what we see. One of my favorite Navajo weavers was this medicine person and a gender human at that too, his name was Hustine Claw. And he did these huge monumental ceremonial sand painting replicas that he wove for the sake of documentation, because he knew that at some point we wouldn't have these ceremonies and practice in the way that we do, that he saw at that time. In a similar light, like, he was at this really interesting transitionary period where he had an opportunity to do that. And he saw that there was a lot of turbulence in our history that may complicate our relationship to those practices and those types of images that we saw. And he called it, because some of those pieces that he wove and ceremonies that he depicted are extinct right now. There's no one who knows those at the capacity that he did. Similarly, when I think about how I view the world and the images that I see, I just hope that I can do a bare minimum okay to mediocre job of getting a good image.
You are well beyond mediocre. Let me assure you, the work is gorgeous and the work speaks for itself. Tyrell, if you had to make a first pass at answering the question, how working with textiles has made you more human, what would you say is the inner work of textiles for you?
When I think about our relationship to textiles, I think about our cosmology and the cultural context that I was brought up in. You know, they were gifts from the divine. They didn't come from nowhere. They originated and have sustained us in times of poverty, in times of turmoil. One of the two classic phrases that kind of have become, if there were a Navajo weaving Bible, these two statements would hold true of learn to weave and you'll never grow hungry, and take care of your sheep and they'll take care of you. These are the things that I really want to encompass and put into my work. And when I think about where weaving came from, I think about our reciprocity with where we are and how we got here and maintaining that. And so when I sit down at the loom, I can't help but think and pay tribute and homage to that relationship, because that's not only something that I experience and have a relationship with my work, but also going back into this lineage that I come from and so many other weavers come from, that's inherently the core and essence of the work. It's just that it documents life, it documents reproduction, and it talks about how that is done between a binary. And it also alludes to the factors and the backbones that don't participate within that binary and reproduction. But when I think about the longevity of it, I think that those ideas and thought processes make us human and what make the work.
And that it can hold it all, right? Like, it makes me think of what you were saying about chaos, about you start with the land and you end with the sky, everything in the middle, that's just what's happening, but the world can hold it all, right?
And to cap that idea off too is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think that's what really holds and shines through in a lot of what I've been learning, is just that none of what I'm doing right now is new. The techniques and all of this mishmashing is nothing new. It's already been done to death. And I'm just another foothold and another blip in its history. And I am more than okay with that, because, like I said, none of this is mine. It's none of the knowledge has been mine. I don't own any of it. I'm just a face of what it can look like.
Amen. 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 I think, just as a way of wrapping up, one image that will always stick with me from this conversation is you tying your great grandma's weaving loom to the top of your car and just like hitting the road. There's just something that's just so beautiful about that.
It's pretty funny. When I, in my seasonal work that I keep talking about. Summers and springs, I'm on the road and or in the air. And I had this exhibition over at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture in Santa Fe. I looked so silly because my vehicle was packed full of yarn, all of my tools, my projects at the time, and then my loom strapped to the top.
I'd have seen that and been like, I want to be that person's friend.
Yeah, I had a couple like studio visits and they'd be like, man, I'm so excited to see what your space looks like. And then we get to the parking lot and I open up my back door and they're like, oh,
that's what it looks like. Well, Tyrell, thank you so much for sharing your time and your story so generously with us.
No problem. Thanks so much, Zach. And I'm so glad that our paths had finally crossed. And I'm looking forward to seeing a lot more of your work and your projects that you're doing, because just as much as I am in the sauce, you are consistently doing everything. So kudos to you, Zach. Sending moral support.
Appreciate it. Now we're all in it together, aren't we? No doubt about it.
Oh, that we are.
It was my great good pleasure to sit down with Tyrell and get to know their work a little bit better and where they're coming from. I hope you enjoyed that conversation too. If you're loving Team Side, two little things you could do for me that I appreciate so much. Number one, consider leaving that 5-star review on Apple Podcast. Or if you'd rather, you can also share on social media. I would love for you to find your favorite episode of Team Side, shout me out, tag me with a little at zachfoster.quilts if you're on Instagram, and I'll be happy to reshare it. All right. Any way we can get the word out about the good things happening here on Team Side is very much appreciated. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Until now and next week, I hope you're well. I hope you're sowing something good. And I hope to see you soon. Maybe on the Nook. Who knows?